You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge. Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 11, given in Dornach on the 1st of November, 1919. In speaking during these days of social questions, among other things, this really is not based on any subjective program, any subjective impulse. But as I have already characterized from all sorts of angles, on observation of human evolution and of the evolutionary forces at work in humanity in our particular era, and on what they prompt us to develop today and in the near future. It is a difficult business to unveil the deeper impulses at work in what concerns humanity's evolution at the present time. For today, people are disinclined to consider important matters with true and profound seriousness. But thorough seriousness is required in relation to the concerns of humanity in our era. Our time prompts us to free ourselves from very specific prejudices, and in particular from presuppositions. Today I'd like to offer a few perspectives that can enable us to view things we have often spoken of in the past in a deeper way. And here we will certainly have to direct our gaze to a somewhat broader context concerning humanity. We distinguish the era in which we currently live, our cosmic present, from other eras, by saying that it started in the mid-15th century, and as you know, we refer to this period as the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. And we divide this from the period that ended when this one began, which in turn started in the 8th century BC, and which we call the Greco-Roman, in reference to the peoples informing and sustaining its culture. And then, going back further still, we identify a previous Egyptian Chaldean epoch. Now, if we look inwardly, of course, at this Egyptian Chaldean epoch, we find that ordinary history falls far short. Even if we study historical records for this period, we cannot delve very far back into the evolutionary history of humanity. And yet, it is only when we can properly understand the distinctive character of this third post-Atlantean epoch that we can draw on it to see things of significance for our modern era. You are aware of one thing above all. In ordinary history, the culture and civilization of the then known world is referred to as pagan. Judaic Hebrew culture sits amidst it like an oasis, and must be seen as a preparation for Christianity. But if we overlook the pre-Christian Judaism, isolated amidst the quite different culture of those times, we can consider the nature of this widespread pagan civilization. What is distinctive about it? It is primarily a culture of wisdom, one of perception and vision of things and occurrences in the world. Even if our, in quotes, clever contemporaries regard the pagan view of the world issuing from the ancient mysteries as being of mythic and pictorial character, it must nevertheless be said that all such images and myths passed down to us originate in profound insights into the nature of things and processes. We need only recall what we sought to characterize as the supersensible wisdom arising in various regions in these ancient times, and we will see that we are concerned here with a primordial wisdom underlying all the thinking, feeling, and sensibility of these ancient peoples. Until the end of the 18th century, and even through into the early 19th century, a certain echo of this primordial wisdom, a tradition that encompassed it, existed and thrived in some secret societies. During the 19th century, this fount more or less dried up, and what remained came to serve the interests of particular groups, and especially particular nationalities. What still exists in ordinary secret societies today can no longer be regarded as authentic and fruitful pagan wisdom originating in ancient times. This store of pagan wisdom has a particular quality that we ought never to overlook if we wish to understand what is really at work here. It has a quality that necessitated the smaller oasis of Judaism establishing itself, as preparation for Christianity, within this larger expanse of pagan wisdom. If we properly perceive this ancient pagan culture, we find that it everywhere contains great and sublime stores of wisdom, wisdom that profoundly penetrates to the very essence of things. And yet this pagan wisdom contains no real moral impulse for human actions. In a sense, these ethical impulses for human action were not needed then, since unlike the human knowledge that exists in our own time, this ancient pagan wisdom really gave people a sense of being rooted in the whole cosmos. The human being dwelling and walking upon the earth did not feel himself constituted only of the substances and forces present outside him in earthly life, in the mineral, animal, and plant kingdoms. The human being felt how forces or powers play into him that also circulate in stars and sun and so forth. He felt himself to be part of the whole cosmos, not only in an abstract way, but his mysteries gave him points of reference for undertaking actions, for his whole conduct, in accord with the course of the stars and planets. The ancient star lore was nothing like the computational astrology to which people today assign importance. This ancient star wisdom was regarded by the leaders of ancient pagan mysteries as the source of real impulses for the actions and conduct of each individual. The human being knew himself to be safely embedded in the cosmos, not only in terms of a generalized wisdom. What he was to do from morning to evening on any day of the year was read for him from the stars, and given to him as directives by those he acknowledged as initiates in the mysteries. But in Chaldean and Egyptian lore, nothing of what the initiates deciphered in this way from the mysteries contained any kind of moral impulse for humanity. Moral impulses, as such, were first prepared through Judaism, which was later developed and elaborated further by Christianity. And now we must ask this: why is it that this glorious ancient pagan wisdom, which came to the loveliest artistic and philosophical flowering in ancient Greece, for example, contained no moral impulses? If, however, we were to go further back to the 3rd millennium B.C., we would find that the impulse of wisdom is at the same time accompanied by a moral impulse too, and that this is absolutely as I have already described, that this impulse of wisdom simultaneously embodied what ancient peoples needed as their moral and ethical principles. But a separate and distinct ethos and moral impulse, as appeared in Christianity, did not, as such, inform pagan wisdom. Why? This was because during the millennia, immediately preceding Christianity, this pagan wisdom drew its source of inspiration from a place far to the east in Asia, from the very remarkable being of Lucifer, who was actually incarnated in the 3rd millennium BC in far-off Eastern Asia. To the knowledge we have gained about humanity's evolution, we must add the fact that just as Christ incarnated at Golgotha in the human being Jesus of Nazareth, so Lucifer also actually incarnated in the 3rd millennium BC in Asia. And a great portion of ancient culture was inspired by this earthly incarnation of Lucifer in a living human being of flesh and blood. Indeed, Christianity, the mystery of Golgotha, as it first unfolded amongst human beings, was originally comprehended in a way inevitably informed by what people had received from ancient Luciferic wisdom. Even the otherwise extraordinarily profound gnosis had limitations that were due to the fact that this Luciferic incarnation exerted its influences across the ancient world. We cannot understand the full significance of the mystery of Golgotha unless we know that it was preceded, not quite 3 millennia earlier, by an incarnation of Lucifer. The Christ incarnation came to add to this Lucifer inspiration what redeems it from one-sidedness. And thus came also what now creates the educative impulse for humanity in regard to the development of European civilization and its American adjunct. But since the middle of the 15th century, since the impulse arose to develop primarily individuality and individual personality, this process of evolution also includes the forces that again prepare the incarnation of a supersensible being. Just as there was a bodily incarnation of Lucifer and an incarnation of Christ in the flesh, so early in the 3rd millennium, since Christ's advent, there will be an actual incarnation of Ahriman, Ahriman in the flesh. This bodily incarnation of Ahriman is not something earthly humanity can escape. It will come. And it is only a matter of earthly humanity finding the right stance toward it. In everything of this kind that happens, when such incarnations are being prepared, we must consider what gradually leads toward them in the evolution of humanity. An entity like Ahriman, who is seeking to incarnate in the Western world at a certain point after this current time of ours, is already preparing his incarnation. As he does so, he guides and governs particular forces in human evolution in such a way as to be very specially advantageous to him. It would be a bad thing indeed if human beings were to sleepwalk toward this and fail to recognize in certain phenomena occurring in human life these preparations for Ahriman's corporeal incarnation. People will only find the right outlook by perceiving in this or that sequence of events informing human evolution how Ahriman is preparing his earthly existence. It is high time that individuals should recognize which of the events and occurrences unfolding around them are the machinations of Ahriman and may be advantageous to him as he prepares his forthcoming incarnation on earth. It would doubtless be most advantageous of all for him if the great majority of human beings had no inkling whatsoever of the things that favor and prepare his coming incarnation, if the great majority of people went about their lives with the view that these unfolding preparations for Ahriman's incarnation were good, progressive, of benefit to and appropriate for human evolution. If Ahriman could sneak into a slumbering humanity, this would give him the greatest pleasure. And this is why we must identify the events and occurrences within which Ahriman is working toward his coming incarnation. One of these evolutionary realities, in which we can clearly discern the Ahrimanic impulse, is the spreading belief amongst humankind that a mechanical, mathematical comprehension of the cosmos, which first arose in the form of Galileism, Copernicanism, and so on, can enable us to understand the life and workings of the cosmos beyond us. This is why anthroposophic spiritual science so keenly emphasizes the need to seek spirit and soul in the cosmos, rather than merely what Galileism or Copernicanism seek, in the form of mathematics, mechanics, as if the world were a great machine. We would succumb to the Ahrimanic temptation if we stopped short at merely calculating the orbits of planets. If we studied only astrophysics rather than delving beyond the physical constituents of heavenly bodies, discovery of which is regarded as such a proud achievement today, it would be grave indeed if we did not counter this Galileism and Copernicanism with knowledge we can gain about the permeation of the cosmos by soul and spirit. But Ahriman, seeking favorable conditions for his incarnation, most definitely wishes to avoid such an outlook. He desires to keep people as dull-witted as possible, in the sense of only comprehending the mathematical aspect of astronomy. For this reason, he seduces many into affirming their commonplace rejection of the existence of spirit and soul in the universe. This, however, is only one of the seductive forces that Ahriman infiltrates, if you like, into human souls. Another of these seductive Ahrimanic forces connected with his forthcoming incarnation, and one might say that he collaborates accordingly with Lucifer, is his endeavor to sustain amongst human beings the already widespread sense that an economically satisfactory existence is all that is required in society. Here we touch on something that modern people are disinclined to acknowledge, which is that modern mainstream science no longer offers anything in terms of knowledge of the spirit and soul. The methods employed in modern mainstream science are fit only for grasping the external characteristics of nature, the external nature, too, of the human being. Consider how disparaging the average citizen is today of anything that strikes him as idealistic, or that in any way suggests to him a pathway of some kind toward the spiritual realm. He will continually ask what use this is, what earthly benefit it brings. He educates his sons at a grammar school or some other institution, then sends them to university or college. But all this serves only, really, to prepare them for a profession, or in other words, to procure the material goods they require or the food they eat. Consider for a moment what we touch upon when we touch on this question. So many people today no longer accord the spirit or the soul any intrinsic value. They take from mainstream culture and knowledge only what they have been told is useful, that has some utilitarian value. And here we must recognize a very important, mysterious fact that holds true today. A solid, average, modern citizen who works at the office industriously from morning till evening, and then participates in the normal evening formalities or customs, will absolutely refuse to engage in the kind of, in quotes, irrelevancies presented in anthroposophic spiritual science. These seem to him superfluous, since after all, as he sees it, These things procure him nothing material. He can't eat them. He believes, though people may often be reluctant to concede this, that all really useful knowledge should ultimately serve to put food on the table. Yes, a curious error that people today so often embrace. They think that the spirit is not something they can eat. And yet the very people who say this are the ones who actually do. You see, to the degree that you refuse in any way to absorb spirit, which would otherwise be assimilated as spirit, you devour spirit with every bite you introduce materially into your mouth and stomach, and conduct it down channels other than the ones it would need to take if it were to be wholesome for humanity. It seems to me a cultural advance that we can safely say most Europeans are not cannibals, but with their American adjunct, they are nevertheless devourers of soul and spirit. Material substance devoured unspiritually means that the spirit slides off on an erroneous path. It is hard to say such things to people today, but try to really grasp for a moment how much of modern culture must be characterized once one knows this fact. And maintaining the human being in this kind of soul and spirit devouring state is one of Ahriman's impulses to support and prepare his coming incarnation. If we succeeded in shaking people awake to recognize, alongside a merely material economy, the autonomous, free life of culture, which really possesses spirit, as a part of the social organism, we could await Ahriman's incarnation with a stance and outlook that accorded with our full humanity. Another strand in our life today, which Ahriman needs to further his own incarnation, is what comes to such prominence today in the, quote, national principle, close quote. Everything that can sunder people into different groups and classes, and distance them from mutual understanding across the globe. Everything that divides and separates them, at the same time furthers Ahriman's impulses. The call for national liberation, even of the smallest states and such like, is one in which we ought to discern the voice of Ahriman. The times have passed when blood ties and national traits should come to the fore. And where such outmoded things are preserved, this furthers what Ahriman seeks to further. Likewise, we further what Ahriman seeks to further if we do not energetically reject what I have often characterized here in the past. Nowadays, there are all kinds of people with the most diverse party political views and outlooks. All these outlooks can equally well be proven correct. You can prove the truth of what some socialist party states just as much as what an anti-socialist party adheres to, and you will have equally valid grounds for doing so. If people do not recognize that this mode of proof is very superficial, and that our present mode of intelligence can prove whatever it likes, both for and against anything, and this is very useful for mainstream science, but useless for another kind of knowledge, then people will fail to see that this superficial intelligence of theirs, so serviceable for science, is something that should not be applied to the life of society, to the life of spirit. Then different groups will prove opposite things to be true. And since both will be valid, it will lead people to hatred and bitterness, of which we have plenty already in our era. These are again things that Ahriman seeks to promote in order to further his own incarnation on earth. Something that will serve Ahriman especially well in furthering his earthly incarnation is a one-sided grasp of the Gospels themselves. You know how necessary it has become in our time to deepen our understanding of the Gospels through spiritual science. But at the same time, you are aware, too, how widespread is the view that understanding of them should not be spiritually deepened, that we ought not to express things relating to the Gospels that issue from a true knowledge of the Spirit, of the cosmos. We ought, apparently, to, quote, simply accept, close quote, them as we meet them today. I have no wish at all to discuss the fact that the true Gospels are not in the least available to us, since what we possess today as translations from the ancient languages of the Gospels are not the Gospels. But let's leave that to one side altogether. Instead, I'd like to speak of the deeper lying fact that we cannot come to a true comprehension of Christ if we seek only, like most confessions and sects today, to engage with the Gospels in what these confessions call a simple way, which actually means easily and comfortably. At the period when the mystery of Golgotha took place, and for a few centuries after it, people comprehended the true Christ, because they could grasp what was said of him with the aid of Luciferic pagan wisdom. This wisdom receded, and what people today draw from the Gospels in their diverse confessions and sects does not lead them to the reality of Christ, whom we seek through our science of the Spirit, but only to an illusion, or at most an hallucination, a soul or spiritualized hallucination of the Christ. It is not possible to reach the reality of Christ if we do not draw on spiritual science to fathom these Gospels. Without this, we delve only as far as an hallucination of Christ's appearance in world history. This has become thoroughly apparent in modern theology. Why are modern theologians so keen to speak of the simple man of Nazareth, and to regard the Christ really only as the man Jesus of Nazareth, someone just a little loftier than other historical figures? It is because people have lost the capacity to approach the reality of Christ, and because what they have drawn from the Gospels takes them only as far as a kind of hallucination, something illusory. They cannot truly encompass the reality of Christ through the Gospels, but only an idea that is hallucinatory or illusory. Think how many theologians speak of Paul's experience near Damascus as, quote, only a vision, close quote. This is a subliminal recognition, really, that their view of the Gospels can offer them only a vision or hallucination. In this they are not mistaken, but are inwardly aware that their experience has no connection with the reality of the Christ being. I am not using the word hallucinatory in any disparaging way, but I want only to characterize how theologians grasp the Christ being only in the same manner as an inward hallucination is produced. If people were to get no further than this, if they did not work their way through to the reality of Christ, but only gained an hallucination of him, Ahriman would find his purposes best furthered. The Gospels likewise amount to a kind of hallucination if we engage only with a single Gospel. We have worked back against this principle of seeing the Gospels in isolation by considering the four Gospels from four different angles. Here it gets us nowhere to take each Gospel literally, for they outwardly contradict each other, as we have often seen. There is a great danger in taking a single Gospel literally. The sects that swear by the literal content of a particular Gospel of John or Luke develop a sort of delusional idea, a kind of twilight consciousness. The dimmed consciousness that would develop precisely through a one-sided engagement with the Gospels, without spiritually deepened understanding, would produce people best fitted to help Ahriman prepare his incarnation. Such people would develop a stance toward him that perfectly served his purposes. This again is an uncomfortable truth for people today. Within their confessions, they think they have no need for anything like anthroposophy, for they keep close to the simple message of the Gospels. Out of humility, they think, they adhere to the simple Gospels. In fact, this is the worst arrogance conceivable. It consists in seemingly taking the Gospels literally, but then overriding the wisdom they contain with judgments they were endowed with by birth, ideas that eddy from their blood. The simplest and most straightforward people are usually the most arrogant, especially in the realm of religiosity and religious confession. Ahriman's coming incarnation is best prepared by people who repeatedly preach the need merely to read the Gospels and nothing more. Remarkably, two very divergent parties work together here. Those I described earlier as soul and spirit devourers, and those who further Ahriman's incarnation, as I just characterized, by simply accepting the literal words of the Gospels. The two very much go hand in hand. If nothing came to light other than the world view of the soul and spirit devourers, on the one hand, and of the literal Christians, on the other, who do not wish to fathom the depths of the Gospels, Ahriman would be able to make everyone on earth an Ahrimanian. The positivist Christianity, disseminated to the world today, is preparing Ahriman's incarnation. In a great deal, one can hear today that claims to represent the orthodoxy of the Church, we ought really to discern a preparation for the works of Ahriman. You see, things today are not as people assume them literally to be. As I have often said, people today live far too much in words, and we need instead to depart from words and enter into realities. We can say that words do, in a sense, sunder people today from the real nature of things. And people are divided most strongly from true being if they bring what is often called straightforward or modest understanding to bear on ancient texts, including the Gospels. It is actually far more modest or humble to really delve into the spirit of things and the Gospels themselves, seeking to understand them from a spiritual perspective. As I have said, Ahriman and Lucifer will always work hand in glove with each other. It is only a question of which of them gains the upper hand in human consciousness at any time. A strongly Luciferic culture holds sway until some time after the mystery of Golgotha, from the incarnation of Lucifer in China in the 3rd millennium B.C. onward. From this incarnation, a particularly strong influence was exerted until the early Christian centuries, and has still gone on working in our own era. But now the signs and traces of Lucifer are growing fainter, since an incarnation of Ahriman is approaching in the 3rd millennium, and the signs of Ahriman are becoming particularly discernible in things such as those I have described. You can say that Ahriman has signed a contract with Lucifer, the words of which can be put as follows, quote, I, Ahriman, consider it especially beneficial for me to claim use of the canned preserves, leaving people's stomachs to you. This latter on the condition that you will allow me to keep their stomachs, that is, human awareness of their stomachs, in a dulled and twilight state. Close quote. What I mean by this is that the people I referred to as soul and spirit devourers remain unaware of the stomach, and what they introduce into their stomachs, they lead directly into the Luciferic stream, unless they bear spirituality in their human nature. What they have eaten and drunk without spirituality goes straight through the stomach to Lucifer. And what do I mean by the canned preserves? I mean libraries and such like, which store academic knowledge undertaken without true interest. knowledge that does not live in people, but in books in a library. Take a look at these academic pursuits, these disciplines that are undertaken without reference to human experience. There are huge numbers of books in libraries everywhere. Whenever a student has to write a scholarly thesis or a doctorate, these are sent off to as many libraries as possible. But quite apart from this, people write and write and write nowadays, and only a very little of what is written is read. Only when people have to prepare themselves in some way for something do they resort to the library shelves, and in turn quote whatever they find there, what is preserved there. These preserved cans of wisdom are highly beneficial to Ahriman and further his preparations. Things are done like this in every field. Things are introduced into the world that would have meaning and purpose if people were actually interested in them, but they are not. And so in all fields we find things that are in a sense separate from the human being. It is enough to make one despair, if one were inclined to despair. Imagine you're involved in a court case, and you need a lawyer to manage it. And then at some point you go and see the lawyer to discuss the case with him. He has no end of relevant papers in a file, for the documents multiply. But if I go to discuss these matters with him, he hasn't a clue about them. He opens the files and looks through all the documents, and gets nowhere. He has no real connection with his files. Here is one file, here another. The files grow. But there is absolutely no interest in them. It is enough to make you despair if you have anything to do with professionals who work like this. They have no connection with the matter in hand, and in reality know nothing about it, since everything is in the files themselves. Little cans of preserves, while libraries are the big cans of spirit and soul preserves. People have no wish to connect with these things, to penetrate them with understanding or interest. And ultimately this gives rise to the mood prevalent today, which fends off anything that requires the head. A little of the head is needed to understand something after all. People wish to refer their confession, their world view, back to the heart alone. Naturally, the heart must be involved, but the way in which people today often speak of their religious confession reminds me of a proverb common in the area where I grew up. Quote, "It's a funny thing, is love. When you buy it, you're buying nothing but the heart, but you get the head thrown in for free." Close quote. That roughly is the mood that expresses what people today like to absorb as their worldview. They want to have it directly through the heart, as they say, without exerting their head, except that the heart doesn't beat without the head. But a lot can be absorbed through the heart, if you actually mean the stomach. And then what the head ought to accomplish for humanity is meant to follow for free. It's meant to be thrown in as an extra, especially in the most important aspects of life. It's important to take note of these things, very important. If you do, you see the seriousness required in relation to human life today, and the need to learn even from the illusions that can proceed from the Gospels, to learn from the predilection for illusions that people have today. The kind of knowledge for which people often seek today will not lead to truth. Using numerical calculations, people think they can supply statistical evidence on which they can rely. Ahriman has an especially easy time with statistics and numbers, and he is very pleased indeed if, say, an academic demonstrates that the population of Macedonia consists of a certain number of Greeks, a certain number of Serbs, a certain number of Bulgarians, for people believe in numbers. And Ahriman does his sums with the numbers people believe in, as I explained to you today. But afterward you realize how certain these numbers actually are, in quotes. Certainly numbers offer specific evidence. But if you delve beyond what you find in accounts and records, backed up by numerical evidence. You will often find that, for instance, in this example of Macedonia, a father is Greek, one of his sons is Serbian, and another son is Bulgarian. Thus the father is included amongst the Greeks, one son amongst the Bulgarians, and another son amongst the Serbians. And so the numbers themselves, which so greatly satisfy people today, fail to take account of the reality of one and the same family containing members of different nationalities, which would lead us to the actual truth. Numbers lead us in a direction which will best help Ahriman make all his figures add up as he prepares for his future incarnation in the third millennium. Tomorrow we will speak further of this. The end of Lecture 11.